Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you. Another visit to Sunday morning wake-up call. So today, I want to talk about the public schools in the U.S., society's current views and use of the school system. So we brought in two folks who are very familiar with that. We have Dr. Pam Moran. She's the executive director of the Virginia School Consortium for Learning. Her name might be familiar because she's the former superintendent for Albemarle County Schools. And Gina Keller. She's the executive director of the Commonwealth Learning Partnership. And she's also familiar from Fluvanna County, where she was the superintendent there. Ladies, thank you for being here.
Thrilled to be with you today.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's just start with that simple but not simple question. The original intent of public education. Gina Keller, can you answer that? I mean, was it more than just teaching kids how to go work in the factories? What was the intent of public education?
I think the key word that you raised was original. And so the original intent was indeed what you just stated. And that was to really bring children in and have skill sets, certainly more an industrial focus. And I will say gladly that has evolved quite a bit over the years. Much of it has evolved. I know Pam and I can speak about things that we think still need to evolve. But I believe the original intent was pretty much that.
Pam, was there agreement that this should be the concept?
Well, it's interesting, Rick, because around the turn of the 20th century, that would be in right around 1900, that as the United States was becoming more industrial and less agricultural, that one of the things that actually the people that were running factories began to communicate to educators is that they needed to have young people who worked differently than perhaps you worked on the farm. And for example, that they wanted people that would come to work at a specific time, that would take breaks at specific times, that could follow directions in the very same way that other people were following directions in terms of the work that they were doing. And they felt like that schools needed to step up and begin to educate people to really be able to work in environments that demanded a high level of compliance. And so at some level, that when we shifted from those little one-room schoolhouses that, you know, we all think about as existing out in the country, and Virginia had its fair share of one-room schoolhouses, including places like Fluvanna and Albemarle County, to really building more comprehensive schools where kids were brought together, that there was a real shift in the curriculum and a focus on who are the kids that are likely going to need to go to work in factories, and there was not an expectation that they would necessarily even stay in school and finish school. I mean, compulsory schooling is a relatively recent phenomenon in the 20th century versus the early part of the 20th century. It was more of a latter part of the 20th century phenomenon. But to have kids be able to go to school, learn to do particular skilled labor, and then go to work, sometimes as young as, you know, 12 or 13 or even younger. And then very few kids were expected to be able to become people that maybe went into professions and finish high school and even go to college. And so, you know, that tiered sort of effect of what school for, mostly for educating people to go to work in jobs that demanded a great deal of duplicated, repetitive kinds of work, and very few that would go into what you might call more white-collar or professional jobs. And so that was kind of the way schools that is going into the 20th century really started to change. And to a great extent, that has stayed in place until probably sometime in the latter part of the 20th century when finishing high school became an important goal for all kids, not just for some.
Well, Ms. Keller, one of the first things I heard Pam mention there was wanting students to learn how to start at the same time and take breaks at the same time, et cetera. Is that really one of the early lessons from public schools is, hey, everybody, you need to be at school at 8 o'clock in the morning and you can't take a break until somebody tells you to. And we all take them together and line up and go down the hallway to this specific room. Was that part of the actual learning, you know, teaching and learning process program in the 1900s?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that you'll find educators even kidding each other a little bit about the only time in your whole life that you walk in a line is when you're in school. And you go down.
Or to go to the movies.
Or when you go to the movies. Yeah, you may have to do a good deal. That's right. But yes, and as Pam said, very focused on compliance, being dependable, the dependability of a child. And I wouldn't necessarily call it the curriculum as much as the structures that were taught, the behaviors, those things that, as Pam had stated, that were expected of students as they came out of school. And I'm sure Pam can, and I know I can as well, speak to family members, my own father, who stopped going to school, and he went to sixth grade, and he started working on a horse farm. And the things as he recalled school that he learned were those things: being dependable, being on time, following directions, following, looking to someone who he reported to. So very different. Certainly, some of those skill sets are still, I would say, are valued and valuable, but very different than what we have for students now. And I'm glad to say that has changed. So that's good.
Well, let me ask, as we sit here and we talk with Dr. Pam Moran from the Virginia School Consortium for Learning and Gina Keller from the Commonwealth Learning Partnership about public schools, the current view and use of schools, and a little bit about the history so we can lay a platform here. If what I'm understanding properly is that the economy and the businesses sort of had a key role in identifying what was important to be taught and how the system, the school system, needed to be initiated and what would be prime for the students to learn. How has it transformed? What are some of the key things that have changed? And Ms. Keller, you go, because you mentioned earlier that you were very happy that some things had transformed.
Yes, and I think the transformation through the years has happened primarily in the curriculum, the standards that are expected, and I'll speak even specifically to Virginia. I will say, though, that the things that that we've held on to a bit more than I would desire as an educator is the sort of these arbitrary calendars of dates, and that learning is often associated with an element of so many hours and, you know, those things. And that could be a whole nother show to talk about Carnegie units and schedules and school calendars and that thing. But the pieces that impact children as they walk into our public school buildings, the pieces that I believe are better suited for giving students an experience where they can grow to be critical thinkers and they can be creative and they are given opportunities to certainly learn how to communicate well with each other, with people who are different than them out in public, et cetera. Those things are so valuable. And those are the things that energize me, even in my work today and even in my work with Pam. Those changes over time, I think, and we haven't, you know, we haven't cornered the market on wisdom, so we haven't gotten to, I believe, where we have all of these pieces coming together beautifully for every child. But the energy is there, the passion is there for us to have these experiences for children that give them opportunity to thrive as a contributing citizen, of society, that the student has choices when they leave high school. And, you know, Pam said, and it's so true, that not until middle to the latter part of the 20th century did we, doesn't mean me personally or Pam personally, but did we collectively see completing high school as an important piece of a child's experience, that had to happen. And so we have opportunities now to better position our students to have choices once they leave high school, and that they can step into a four-year secondary, post-secondary program. They could go into two-year. They definitely have more choices than certainly our parents had, and that maybe even we had going to school. I graduated high school in 1976. And those choices that I had, even as a female, were pretty narrow compared to what can happen now for children. So, yes, lots of changes there.
Well, and I do think that, Rick, to add to what Gina's saying, piggyback on that, you know, that the skill sets that were demanded in the early part of the 20th century for kids going into a workforce were very different than I think what companies and even businesses today are asking of their employees. That where employees in the factory model were really expected to be people who followed directions, that just sort of worked in really automatic ways to, you know, whether it was on an assembly line in some of the early auto factories or the repetitive kind of work of, you know, working in a mill, that business owners of that time were not asking for employees that could work together, because oftentimes they were working in isolation of each other. They didn't ask for employees that could do critical thinking because they wanted to do the thinking for the employees in terms of what their expectations were that they would accomplish in a work day. They weren't really particularly interested in employees being particularly creative, because they wanted to be able to do work that would be highly efficient in terms of the kinds of metrics that they were doing. So they weren't looking for people to think about how many different kinds of screws that they could make in a day. They wanted them to be able to machine one specific screw. And so, you know, from that perspective, what you will find out if you look at any of the research that's being done in finding out what do employees today need, it's a very different set of skills. It's what America Succeeds, which is a group that really focuses on how do we really make sure kids are being prepared to go to work in a competitive global economy, be able to work in their local communities. And what they talk about are durable skills that are really different kinds of competencies than perhaps what employers in 1910 would have said they wanted. And yet, one of the things that's true is that despite the fact that we're now about to finish the first quarter of the 21st century, that schools are still functioning very similarly to what they did in the 20th century. And so that's a real challenge. And I think that the pandemic and even the recession in 2009, 10, that period, really threw some kinks in the system in terms of how educators are being expected to teach and how educators are being expected to work with kids differently. And some of that's being driven by the economy. Some of it's driven by what communities perceive that their kids need. Some of it is being driven by just the changes in the way the world works as a result of technology.
Again, we are talking with Gina Keller, Executive Director of the Commonwealth Learning Partnership, and Pam Moran, Executive Director from Virginia's School Consortium for Learning, as we discuss U.S. public schools, the view, current use. Pam, would you agree that public schools have become as much a use for providing social welfare as teaching and learning?
Well, you know, maybe I should get you to define what you mean by social welfare, Rick, but I think that what I noticed across my career, and my career spanned four decades plus of jobs from my first entry into the classroom in the mid-1970s to my exit as a superintendent in 2018, that I saw a significant shift over that time, both in terms of the community's expectations of what schools needed to do in order to support young people across a lot of demographics, to seeing that educators have been expected to take on greater numbers of jobs and different kinds of jobs that go beyond just coming in to work every day and being expected to teach kids throughout the day and then go home and do your lesson plans and grade papers and then get up and you know, rinse and repeat. That at the point where I was leaving as a superintendent, we had teachers in schools that were helping to pack up food packages and backpacks for kids to take home in conjunction with working with food banks. We had teachers who were, working with kids before school, after school, giving up planning periods to work with kids, sometimes dealing with, family kinds of issues that they felt like that they needed to support up children to be able to handle in school, being able to deal with custodial parents. That was one that really emerged over my career, that when I started out as an elementary principal, I did not find myself spending much time dealing with custodial agreements with parents who were separated or divorced. By the time I left 10 years of elementary principal work, I found myself working through a lot of issues around how do you communicate with parents that are separated or divorced in ways that really were trying to meet the needs of parents with different perspectives, different value systems, and an expectation, a legal expectation, that we would work with parents differently, whether it was parent conferencing or provision of materials to parents, communication with parents, monitoring who had custody on which week and so forth. And so there were things like that became much more complicated in terms of factors inside the school that probably a lot of people never thought about. Another one, and maybe Gina might talk to this, is just simply dealing with the medical needs of kids in schools as medication started coming in schools. Gina, I mean, you probably saw that as a school counselor too.
Well, let's take a break and we'll come back and get into that, because that's exactly where I was going with social welfare. And we'll expand on some of those issues and get into them in a little more depth. Dr. Pam Moran with us, Gina Keller. We talk about public schools, the current view, and their current use. We'll be right back. And thank you for being here with us today. Sunday morning wake-up call. So, Dr. Moran, you mentioned a few specifics to my comment about our public schools becoming somewhat of a distributor of social welfare. You mentioned food. And as you said, schools are providing free food to families. You mentioned health. And that comes in various forms, whether it's physical health in today's 2022 world. There's a little less under the COVID scene because you can't do but so much, but most schools have nurses. You're almost required to have vaccinations, and I'm not talking about COVID, but you're required for students to have vaccinations to get into the school system. There's mental health. You've got teachers and school psychologists there to identify, and they're trained to look for mental illness and to prompt treatment. You've got, and this is a big one for me, is I think during the initiation of the COVID fallout, when schools were closed and went, or excuse me, schools weren't closed, but they went virtual, the biggest complaint was almost that they loss of daycare. The schools somewhat act as a free source of childcare for working parents. And that seemed to be the biggest rush to get the students back into the classroom. And there are other forms that we can talk about, but Gina Keller, can you comment on some of these, how we started taking on this social welfare aspect of schools doing this?
Certainly, and thank you. I would say a perfect question for me. And as I think back in my role as a homeschool coordinator years ago, probably in the late 80s, and mid to late 80s, the state of Virginia did not have, as a requirement, did not have counselors for elementary schools. We had counselors at the high school and were considered guidance counselors. And if you recall, in your own educational experience, guidance counselors assisted with classroom schedules, and certainly no counselors in the schools were given the opportunity nor the authority to be therapeutic in nature. But there really was a kind of a boxed in, this is the list of the things you do to help the student. And almost while there were great relationships being built with counselors and children, almost robotic in a way. And so one of the things that I did with a social worker with their local Department of Social Services is we wrote for a grant, for a two-year grant, where we could gather data and show the need for counselors in elementary schools, for counselors who would be there and assist in evolving the mindset of our educators around the whole child. So if you look at the whole child versus I send my kids to school and they learn math and then they go to their English class and sometimes just in isolation of each other. So math and then you have English and sort of those core subjects, science, social studies. They have phys ed, they go outside and play, PE or gym or whatever it was called. But often, and I would say as the standard many, many years ago, and I don't know exactly when that shifted, but I know in Virginia, I believe it was in the mid-80s or so, Pam, you may know, when in our standards of quality, we were able to have counselors in an elementary school. And so our data, it was rough. It was a rough collection. It wasn't It probably wasn't super scientific, but it certainly did share the story that there was a need. Because what I encountered in my work as a homeschool coordinator, and then I have a counseling degree as well, and I went into full-time counselor role in an elementary school after that, was that I encountered what I would call the very humane and human aspects of working with children that when I'm working with them, had little or nothing to do with them learning math, but then had a lot to do with their ability to learn math, if that makes sense. My job was to start showing the connection, that how that child was thriving or not thriving in the home space, or how that child's needs were being met in other spaces, impacted that child's ability to learn. If the child came hungry, those children were not positioned well to learn. And so many, many years ago, very natural tendencies of educators, and I'm just speaking in the elementary school I was working in then, was to bring food for children, to make sure that there were snacks and things available. And this was before universal breakfast programs where everyone could eat and food was available. And as Pam was speaking, that we packed backpacks before children even brought backpacks to school. We put it in bags. And so it was just meeting the need of the whole child. And it really shifted the thinking of that particular school in that district about our role, because we started seeing ourselves not as separate. You know, a parent or a bus drops a child up to school. They're our responsibility for so many hours. We dump a bunch of information in their brain, and then they go home. And there were people who really believed that that was their job. And it evolved over several years in a beautiful way, where educators saw that their role was bigger than that. It was about building those relationships. It was about nurturing and nudging children. It was about seeing children and the needs, their socio-emotional needs, their own personalities coming into play, and that we weren't educating robots sitting in a row that came without feelings, sometimes they came and they were harmed, you know, they had been harmed, and sometimes they came and they weren't positioned well, they didn't have the skill sets to even know how to learn and to be included and be collaborative. So I think there was a lot of beautiful work done that was, for me, I would say was just a natural extension of being a caring human being. And I, of course, I believe even in the toughest of times, Pam and I were talking about this just recently, you know, the vast majority of educators are such caring people, and they came into that role to care and to create impact. And I know we can talk a bit more about that. I think that's what's happening right now, that they're not sure they have some impact. And that's tough. That's a hard thing to deal with. But our children needed us more than just needing to know math equations. And that was a beautiful journey that I was able to be a part of and to help lead.
I do think that, Rick, a companion to that conversation is that what happened is that as educators assumed more and more responsibility, because I describe us as really being a whatever-it-takes profession, that if a child comes in hungry and we know that hunger will impede their capability to learn, teachers go out and they buy snacks, or the school division starts to provide more resources or partners with organizations to provide more resources. So the teacher may find that they are now volunteering to help stuff backpacks, which was not something they did 30 years ago. If a child comes into school and they have a medical condition that demands that the teacher needs to, quite frankly, perform some medical activities to support a child, our teachers get trained to do those kinds of things, because a school nurse is not always available to do that, or a secretary might do that. So that what I think we've seen is that educators have taken on more and more responsibility that was not asked of them in the generation of educators that came before me or even in my early part of my career, but that as we've added those tasks to what teachers do, it's added other kinds of expectations in their lives to not just be teachers, but to be counselors, to be social workers, to be medical, paramedical staff, to be all kinds of things that they were not expected to be in earlier generations necessarily. At the same time, what I think that's also done is it's caused people who have always worked hard, and you know, people think that teachers have sometimes that are on the outside think teachers have these easy jobs, but I think, Rick, you may have some educators in your family, so you know educators work hard, that all of a sudden now they're being spread across so many fronts that it's really kind of hard for them to be able to just stay as on point on the learning side of the work, which is the academic side, because they are really attending to a lot of needs that would not have been maybe in the job description at some point in time. So I think that it's made it more complicated for teachers and other educators as well, school secretaries being one. It's also created an expectation that educators, whatever need emerges, that somehow the community always turns to the educators to be the problem solvers and the solution finders to step in and take that next step to help with whatever the need happens to be. And as a result of that, I think that right now that we are seeing probably the highest stress load in educators that I have ever seen. And, of course, it's in the news pretty much every week about the numbers of educators that are either intending to leave or have left the profession. We have more open jobs in Virginia at this point in the year than superintendents and principals and HR directors have ever seen. I just heard that in recruitment fairs that, you know, that when a region, say in the Valley or in the Richmond area, puts on a recruitment fair to have teachers come in to interview for jobs for next year, they're seeing significantly less educators in that pool that are wanting to even interview for jobs. We have fewer people choosing to go into the profession. College kids have a lot of opportunities today that didn't exist for me when I was graduating from college as a woman, that today the doors are wide open to make more money and do things that are meaningful, and education may not be on the top of the list for a lot of people that might have made that choice in 1970. So, you know, I think that it's complicated, but the thing that worries me is that I always say to teachers anytime I'm in a meeting with them, they represent the most important profession on earth, because who we are as civilization, as humanity, to a great extent can be attributed to the teachers that have helped kids develop knowledge and skill sets and competencies and capabilities and talents to become, you know, the future doctors and engineers and inventors and astronauts and poets and dancers and all the things that fuel who we are as humanity. To a great extent, I attribute that to the fact that teaching exists as a profession. So it worries me that people are not seeing it as a profession of value, that people are leaving in droves right now, and people are feeling like that as educators that they are between a rock and a hard place in terms of being able to meet the expectations that communities have for them. And they can't please, not only cannot please everybody all the time, they're having a hard time right now pleasing anybody any of the time. And that is a real challenge.
Talking about the current view and current uses of the U.S. public school system. That was Dr. Pam Moran from Virginia School Consortium for Learning. We have Gina Keller here with us as well from the Commonwealth Learning Partnership. Gina, do you think that some of this stress is coming from the general dissatisfaction through partisanship in politics?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Here's what I see. Not that many years ago, local politics were local politics. There's always, you know, I've been a superintendent, Pam's been a superintendent, and that is a very political position. And by saying that, that's not tagging it as good or bad. It just is. And so being positioned as a superintendent or a teacher or any educator, really, then quite often you are one of the biggest in the school districts, especially in rural communities. We're typically the biggest employer, largest employer. It was certainly in Fluvanna. We were seen, and this is in 2010, 2012, 2014, and after an economic downturn. So there were lots of tough things to work through. But my point is the politics were local politics, and the community still rallied around those teachers, those educators. The schools were the hub, you know, the hub of the community activities, and there was a lot of joy around the successes of the schools. And it didn't mean everything was perfect and rosy. It's not about that. But that there was this level of support and appreciation for what educators brought to children in their lives and their families and their communities. And then what I've seen, especially lately, is that the national politics have sort of found their way into local, they've become local politics. And what I mean is this, that I used to be able to go to even school board meetings, and you wouldn't know what political party a person might be associated with. And that's not necessarily the case anymore. And so the dialogue has shifted, and there's, I would even say, a bit of an element of some people call it passion. Some people, there's even a thread of maybe some anger and angst after, you know, 2 years in a pandemic, and then it's like this big knot of rubber bands, and every rubber band has something written on it, like COVID and just the whole pandemic piece, the political climate across our nation, that again used to stay separate for the most part. And my point is there's a bit of an unraveling that's really bothersome to me. And as Pam was talking, I so agree with, you know, how she speaks and what she believes, because I believe the same thing and see the same thing with their educators and their teachers, is that teachers, and there's actually a new research researched information that's coming out of JMU that really nails it on the head about the fact that teachers, educators, when they don't feel that they're making an impact, that they're not, I mean, that's why they come in. They're making an impact. They're making an impact, generational impact on our society. There's impact. When they don't feel and don't see that as happening, then I think they just unravel, and the system can so quickly unravel. But I will tell you, I'm probably one of the most Pollyanna people there ever was. And so if anything, those kind of things energize me to make it work and find the connecting points and find the possibilities out there to turn this ship around and get our young people energized about coming into the teaching profession and impact lives.
That's Gina Keller with us, Executive Director of the Commonwealth Learning Partnership. We also have Dr. Pam Moran from Virginia School Consortium for Learning. Let's take our next break, and we'll be right back and continue talking about public schools and their current view and use. Hang tight. And we're back. Thank you for being with us here on another lovely Sunday morning wake-up call. Dr. Pam Moran and Ms. Gina Keller here as we talk about U.S. public schools. Gina, you were talking about the effect that partisan politics plays on those in the public school field of education. So, Pam, can you give me your thoughts? Because you're not in the public school system and in your superintendent role anymore. Although I do want to learn a little bit before we finish up our hour here in our final segment about each of your organizations. But there's a lot of conversation about parental input. Parents want more input into what's going on in the schools, what's being taught, what books are in the libraries. Should my child wear a mask? I don't care if that child wears a mask or not. So I'd like to get both of your reactions to this parental input, and we'll start with you, Pam.
All right. Thanks, Rick. Always love to be in the hot seat on a Rick Moore show. But the thing I think about is that have a great luxury today being out of the superintendent job of being able to have a little bit of the feel of an armchair quarterback, because I'm not having to make those tough decisions in the same way that superintendents are in their roles right now. But one of the things that I will say is that in the same way that at the political national level that we see almost 50-50 divides in a lot of survey data and polling data, whether it's about specific political candidates or about votes, about elections, about opinions on topics of import to people that exist at the national level, that I think that, as Gina said, that has really bled into local communities in a way that's really put schools in a pretty tough position. I think the mask issue is one that definitely fits into that mix, because, you know, for every parent that thinks that their child should be wearing a mask in school, in some areas of our state, you've got at least one parent or more who believe that their child should not be required to wear a mask. And so when a superintendent and a school board have to make a call about, so are we going to go with everybody wears mask, nobody wears mask, or people get to choose to wear mask or not, one of the things that they have to think about is what are the risk factors that are attached to those different decisions. And so if you come down on the side of we want everybody in mask because we're trying to protect kids who might potentially end up with COVID from getting COVID, particularly kids that are medically fragile, all of a sudden you've got a group of parents pushing back and saying, well, I don't care if those kids, you know, need to wear a mask, they can wear them, but my kid, I don't want. And so you find that it's a real no-win. And that's one of the reasons why not only are we seeing teachers leaving the profession in droves, but we have the largest probably number percentage of superintendents leaving jobs in the country that we've seen in, well, maybe forever. I don't think I've ever seen anything like it right now in terms of superintendents leaving jobs too. And so, you know, those kinds of critical issues, and you can say, well, it's all about communication, but if I have a value system that's different than your value system and I'm not willing to compromise and you're not willing to compromise, then all of a sudden you've got school boards and superintendents and principals and teachers in the middle of parent values that where people are not willing to compromise. Books in the library is another example. If I'm a parent who really wants my child to have access to books that perhaps are ones that are written by authors that I think are fine for my child to read, and I actually want my child to read those authors, and you're a parent who doesn't want those books in the library, we may not be able to find a common ground in there. You know, I dealt with, as a principal, elementary principal, then as a curriculum director, book challenges in Albemarle County. And I could put together a group of parents in a room, parents and staff, to consider a challenge to a particular book being used in a curriculum. And we could come out with a compromise. We could come out with a common ground where both sides felt like they were getting something that they wanted from the process. or that people would feel like that when it was done, that their voices had been heard and that mattered to them. That doesn't feel the same today as it felt 20 years ago. And that, I think, is one of the biggest challenges we have. And it's not just about education. It really cuts across, I think, who we are as a nation, who we are as states, and who we are as communities. What are we willing to do to create an environment where we can all feel like that we can get a win-win versus a win-lose or even a lose-lose, which is even worse? But it's tough. It's tough watching what's going on. Parents should have a voice in their children's education. I used to say, and I learned this from somebody that was probably more wise than I am, that a child's first teacher is their parent and that we should honor that. But at the same time, education is not about serving just one group. It's about trying to figure out how do we meet the needs of an entire group. And no one parent group is particularly more important in terms of their value system than another when it comes down to their own children. And so that's, I think, the really tough piece about whether it's issues about what should be in the curriculum, what should be in the library, what issues are, you know, how do we approach teaching controversial issues? I mean, to be having conversations in some states about whether it's okay to teach about Nazi Germany or about slavery is mind-boggling to me, because we've been teaching about those things going back, you know, a long time, decades and decades. And all of a sudden now that's become an issue. I don't get it, quite frankly. But I think the critical thing is, how do we as educators really approach working with parents so that we are hearing their voices, we are being responsive, we are communicating transparently, and ultimately I have to believe, and I'm an educator, so I'm coming at this from a bias, that we have professionals in our schools who are hired to do the job, and that we should be allowing them to make the judgment calls. And I don't see, we see a lot of what I call datum points out there in the media, a teacher who did this or a principal who did that. The reality is the majority of teachers that are in there doing the work that they do day in and day out are doing it with great integrity, with great common sense, and they are responsive and have good relationships with teachers, I mean with parents. And so to me, this loss of trust should not be something that we are allowing partisan politics to take away the trust that we have spent decades building in terms of our public education entity. And that's hard to see it, but I think that we just are going to have to work really hard to build back from where we are right now as a nation, as a state, and as communities. And that means that we've got to really be people have got to sit down at the table and really talk through some things instead of just talking at things. And that's key. We are doing a lot of talking at each other, but not a lot of talking with each other about the things that matter.
That's Dr. Pam Moran from the Virginia School Consortium for Learning. Gina Keller with us as well, Commonwealth Learning Partnership. Gina, so that you can get in on that part of the question about parental input, but you also do something at the Learning Partnership called Voices from the Field. I didn't know if that tied together. Are you getting, when you, because my view of Voices from the Field is getting, is talking with people who do this education on a daily, you know, they go to work every day and this is their career. If you've had a chance to talk with them about parental input, or they're telling you about parental input?
Somewhat. The Voices from the Field or it still is, an opportunity for us to hear from educators, you know, the boots on the ground, the people who are there day to day. And we started that particular virtual opportunity for those who wanted to just to sign in and listen. It was through a Zoom meeting. And we showcased several school districts, different topics, different focus areas. Some of the teams, Stafford, for example, wanted to talk about how they were addressing the diverse needs of children through this virtual learning. Louisa County did a similar, you know, they came together. There were about 10 educators, 10 teachers who talked about what they had to do in order to pivot to meet children's educational needs during the pandemic. So, yes, that was absolutely a wonderful venue for that, and that will continue. Again, we go for a few months, we stop for a little bit, and then we come back because what we find, too, is that people have Zoom fatigue, so they're not necessarily so interested in being on a Zoom call in the afternoon or late hours. But one thing I did want to add real quickly, and Pam, you know, was speaking about this, and I think one of the things that's so important for us to remember is that a parent's view of a child's school or their child's educational experience is so often fueled and fed by day-to-day interactions with that child. And with that child, as the child comes home and the child speaks about what's going on at school, the child's relationship with the teacher or teachers, the other educators who have built relationships. And if you think about it, we've lost that for over 2 years. We've lost the human connection. And we can be really excited and very appreciative of opportunities that are virtual opportunities. But there is nothing more powerful in terms of an impact on a child than walking into a school where that child is taken care of and loved. And I'm not talking about just the feeding, just that, the feeding, the clothing, the medicine. We've become sort of a microcosm of society in how we respond to the needs of a child. And we can debate that as well for, you know, many moons to come. But the point is we've lost that connection. And Pam hit the nail on the head when she said, you know, we almost have become a grab-and-go society in terms of how we speak with each other through Twitter. Twitter gives you little nuggets. You can get on Facebook. You can, you know, we can be on a phone. But until we are back, I believe this with everything in me, until we're back face-to-face with our children in a predictable pattern, then we will, until that happens, we're not going to see the things that we know to be so profoundly impactful for that child. And that's that human connection and they're learning and they're thriving and they're moving and moving ahead. They're making gains. These children who are able to be in a space that they feel safe. All of those things do matter. And again, if you think about it, they've not had that kind of consistent, predictable day-to-day interaction for a long time. And we've got to work hard to get that back, and we've got to work hard to build the trust again in our public education.
Yeah, and I would say, Rick, when you talk about parent input, that, you know, I don't run into educators that see parents as the enemy, and I don't run into parents who see educators as the enemy. Sometimes it feels that way when you see these soundbite cuts on the media from school board meetings that have just kind of gone wacky over the last couple of years in some cases, or you read about situations, as I said, that are datum points. It's not data. It's a particular situation vignette or story that you read it and you think, oh, my gosh, if it's representative of what's going on in schools, yeah, you can get on board with that. But the reality is that, you know, educators for years have been begging for parents to be actively engaged in their schools. They want them to come to parent conferences. They want them to volunteer in schools. They want them to be a part of curriculum committees, to come to school board meetings, have their voices be heard. And, you know, sometimes you got to be careful what you wish for because you might get it. And it hasn't been particularly pleasant in a lot of places over the last 2 years in terms of the interactions that have occurred. But the reality is that parents are and teachers together are what makes a school and a school community thrive, when it's all working and people are communicating well and that people are valuing each other as members of that community. And, you know, it's not always rosy. I certainly, as an elementary principal, at times had to deal with situations that were very uncomfortable. But if you're willing to put yourself in the arena, as Teddy Roosevelt said in his Man in the Arena speech, that if you put yourself in the arena and you bring your courage in your heart, you're going to have failures and you're going to have successes. But when you finish the day, you ought to feel like that what you've done has really made a difference. And so, you know, I think that it's a good thing that parents are kind of, you know, really taking the time to figure out what's happening in schools on both sides of the political spectrum, and to really figure out, you know, what is on their minds and what's worrying them and what they really want for their children. But I think that you, if you're looking at parent engagement as parent engagement, and Gina is a real proponent of family engagement, and that we need to do a much better job of that, it's not about just being upset about a book that your child's reading. It's about, are you going to your child's parent conferences? Are you being involved in the school activities that are going on as a parent? Are you really putting yourself out there to make yourself a part of that school community for the good of the entire community? And that when things are not going the way you want, that you're able to feel like you can talk to your principal and talk to your child's teacher and share what is worrying you. I will never forget, to just end on this story, Rick, I'll end on this. I will never forget one of the first experiences I had as an elementary principal, long time ago, decades ago, was that celebrating Christmas had become something that was being challenged in schools. And it was being challenged from both sides, from parents that wanted to have traditional Christmas celebrations in schools, and some parents that it offended because of their own belief systems. And so I will never forget that I had a first grade teacher when I was an elementary principal, and I had a parent come in to me who was incredibly upset because the teacher had set up a center in the back of the room where children could make Christmas ornaments as gifts for their family. And so it was a first grade center. I had another parent who came in almost within 24 hours who was incredibly upset that the teacher was not doing more to make Christmas a part of all of the activities that were going on in the month before the winter holidays. And so there I found myself in a 24-hour period dealing with a parent who felt like we were going too far and a parent who felt like we were not going far enough. That is this phenomenon of parents having different value systems and beliefs about what schools should do. It's not new news to educators, but I think it's become so prevalent, as Gina said, because people are not in a place where they are face-to-face in a lot of the communication that's going on. It makes it easy for it to become. I think that the buzzword of the day is divisive, and I think that, divisiveness is probably the biggest issue that we have right now, is not figuring out how do we reach across the aisle to each other and work it out. And as Gina said, face-to-face is always the best way to do that.
Well, we're going to have to finish there. So, again, lots of information and some great stories, thoughts, and views from our guest today, Dr. Pam Moran, former Albemarle County Superintendent with Virginia School Consortium for Learning, and Gina Keller, former Fluvanna County Superintendent with Commonwealth Learning Partnership. Ladies, thank you both for a great hour.
Rick, thrilled to be with you.
Thank
today.
You.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you.
All right, everyone. See you again next time.